On Tuesday, January 29th at 10 p.m., Shug in My Bowl presents a memorial broadcast dedicated to pianist, composer, producer, and Pan-Africanist Randy Weston, originally aired in 2010 in celebration of the 50th anniversary of Uhuru Africa and the release of African Rhythms, the autobiography of Randy Weston. That's Tuesday, January 29th at 10 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is pianist, composer, producer, and Pan-Africanist, Randy Weston. I'll be co-hosting this program with our associate producer, Hank Williams. We'll even get a question in from our videographer, Kazembe Balagoon. This is a rebroadcast from September 2010, and we don't have a lot of time. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl starting now.
This is Hank Williams, and I'm here with Joyce Jones, and we have a wonderful guest, which is NEA jazz master, practitioner of African rhythms, and now doctor, as he has an honorary doctorate from Brooklyn College, Brooklyn's own Randy Weston. And we also need to add another title to his already impressive credentials, which is that of composer, since his new autobiography, also titled African Rhythms, is just about to be released by Duke University Press. Randy, welcome. How are you doing?
Fine, Hank. How about yourself?
I'm doing wonderful.
Thank you, Randy Weston, for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Thank you.
Glad to have you.
Pleasure to be in the Sugar Bowl.
So, Randy, would you like to talk a little bit about the composition process with the book with Willard Jenkins, who also has credit as co-author or, in this case, arranger? Perhaps you could talk a little bit about what the process was like getting down your story and collaborating with him, and actually possibly if the process of writing is different from your compositional process in music.
Well, you know, what I did was I really talked in the microphone, you know. It was the same thing I did with Melville Liston when we worked together, you know. And I just went back as far as I could go back, you know, time I can remember. And I talked about growing up in Brooklyn, in the Bedford Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, and my father, my mother, the neighborhood. And from that point on up until today.
The title of the book is African Rhythms, and that's also what you call your current group. I know you talk in the book about it and have talked about it extensively in interviews, but maybe you could go through that briefly for our listeners in terms of your approach to the music and how you see that coming together.
Well, I think it came about it was in the late 50s. I was at Max Roach's house, you know, with Max Roach and Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and George Russell. And we were discussing the word jazz. And they said we never use the word jazz. We always say, let's play Ellington's music or Lena Horne's music or Count Basie. We never use the word, but it's called jazz, you know. And so listening to that conversation, I was thinking in my mind, what would I call my music, you know. And for me, the most natural way to describe my music would be African rhythms. And the reason for that is, I guess, my Panamanian Jamaican father, my Virginia mother, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and being with all the cultures of African people from the continent, from the Caribbean. And for me, whether it was Southern fried chicken or whether it was some cooking from the island, it was a great similarity. And as my dad said, we are an African people. we never left Africa spiritually, no matter where we are on the planet. So I decided to call my music African Rhythms, because in my music is a combination of all the various names of what we call music, blues, jazz, calypso, all the different names, you see. But it's Mother Africa's contribution to music.
We see that in a lot of your compositions.
Tell us about arranger, trombonist, Melba Liston.
Well, you know, I used to play with a trio at Birdland opposite big bands like Count Basie and Dizzy Gillespie brought his band in, you know. This was like, early 50s, late 40s maybe, something like that, you know. And in the band, he had Charlie Persip, he had Lee Morgan, he had all these giants, you know. And he did an arrangement. Melba Liston was a trombonist, and she wrote an arrangement of My Reverie. And this arrangement was so beautiful, you know. So she came off the bandstand. I just said, I just got to meet you, you know. She was a beautiful lady, great big sound, that trombone, and the arrangement was beautiful. And that's how we met. And at that time, I don't think she was living in New York, but she eventually moved to Harlem. And I met her a couple of times, and finally I had an opportunity to do a recording for United Artists. And I did 7 waltzes for children, and I wanted her to do the arrangements. And that's how it started. And I went to a little place up in Harlem, and I explained all the songs. One song is for a little boy, one for a little girl, my son, my daughter. One song for children ice skating. Another song for children climbing a hill. Another song for children singing the blues. Another song called Earth Birth, when a child arrives on the planet. It's music, you know. So Melba took it from there. And we got together Johnny Griffin, Ray Copeland, Idris Suleiman, Jamil Nasser on bass, and Charlie Persip on drums. And that was our first collaboration. And I was extremely happy. And the recording got something like 5 stars, because Melba, she was an original arranger in the sense she could take a small group and make it sound like a big band. And she was completely original.
Yeah, I'm actually learning more and more. The more I read about you, the more I learn about Mel Ballistic.
Oh, yeah. That was the beginning. And we worked together till the time she died. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did she feel about playing trombone? How was she as a musician?
She was a great trombonist. She had a huge sound. I never saw a woman playing trombone in the first place. First of all, I saw a woman playing trombone. She had this big, fat sound. But Melba was very shy. She's a very shy person. And when we did the first recording of the waltzes for children, I wanted her to play on the first piece, which is called Earth Birth, you know. And I had to fight with her to make her play on that piece because every piece featured a different musician. So I finally got her to play on it, but she loved to write. Arranging and composing was her real love, but for me, she was a great trombonist.
Well, since we started talking about Melba Liston, why don't we talk a little bit more about the Uhuru Africa recording?
Well, Melba and I, we were very close in many things. We had great pride in our people. We didn't like the image of our people, you know, and we were very sensitive of that. And I wanted to create a work of music to show us and to show the world that we're a global people. And we're in many parts of the planet, and we speak many different languages, but we all come from the same foundation, Mother Africa, our ancestral home. And that's where we get our spiritual energy from. So I put together a four-part suite. The first movement was called Freedom Now. And I went to the great Langston Hughes, who I got to know. I said, Langston, would you kindly write a freedom poem for me for Uhuru Africa? He said, of course. I wrote another song called African Lady. It's very important for us to recognize our mothers, our sisters, our daughters, those women that don't get the recognition that they should. So I wrote a song called African Lady and asked Langston, would he do a text for that? He said, of course he would. So that was kind of like the beginning. So the first move was Freedom Now. Second move was African Lady. The third move was Bantu. Bantu means Africa and the South coming together. And the last movement was called Kucheza Blues. And that blues is symbolic the day when African people get their freedom all over the planet. We're going to have a big party called Kucheza Blues. Now, going back a little bit, as a boy growing up, I was always upset about the image of our people, you know, the Tarzan movies, all the stereotype you see in the cinema as a kid. But what made an impact upon me, the impression was we had no language when language was created in Africa. So I wanted to put Langston's poem into an African language. And I spent time in the United Nations talking to various diplomats at that time. And like this is the late 50s. And they all suggested that Kiswahili would be a good language to represent Africa. So I approached a man from Tanzania. His name was Tuti Mekisanga. He was a teacher of Swahili, and he was a delegate at the United Nations, you know. And he agreed to not only translate Langston's poem into Kiswahili, but he would also narrate on the recording because he had a great voice, you know. So that was the narration and the arranging side of the music. And now the musicians, it was an incredible orchestra. The reed section was Bud Johnson on tenor saxophone, Gigi Grice alto saxophone. We had Cecil Payne on baritone. We had Jerome Richardson on flute and also on saxophone. We had Les Spann also on flute and guitar. And we had Sahib Shahab also playing alto saxophone. And then we had Kenny Morrell on guitar. We had Max Roach playing marimba. Charlie Pasipa on drums. You had Candido and Amanda Peraza from Cuba. You had Babatunde Odetunji on African percussion. You had Ron Carter on bass and George Vivier on bass. That was a powerful rhythm section, right? The trombone section was Slide Hampton, was Quentin Jackson and Jimmy Cleveland. We had Julius Irvin playing French horn. The trumpet section was Freddie Hubbard, Richard Williams, and Clark Terry. Okay. We had two great singers, Martha Flowers, she sang African Lady, and Brock Peters also sang African Lady.
How did you get Brock Peters, by the way?
Well, how did I get all of these people?
Exactly.
It was in the air somehow. And Candido had to go somewhere. I forgot where it was. So we had to schedule the recording at 9:30 in the morning, 2 days in a row. Nobody was late. It was a spiritual undertaking. And Melba not only wrote the arrangements, she had musicians in my house all night long writing parts on the ceiling, on the walls. We had to carry the copyist on a chair. His ankles were swollen. We had to carry him down the stairs and carry him to the studio, still writing parts. Because Melba was very creative. She would do an arrangement, and last minute she would change something, you know. And she also conducted. So for me, it was a very incredible moment. I mean, her arrangements were original, flawless, daring, and to see this African woman not only write the arrangements, but also conducted the orchestra. So that was Uhuru Africa, and it was we recorded that in November 1960. And what's ironic about that, which I didn't realize until this year, in 1960, 17 African countries got their independence. So this year, 2010, the celebration of Uhu Africa, our collaboration with Melville Disson, Langston Hughes, and myself, and also the 17 countries of Africa. So it was a powerful experience and a spiritual experience, yes.
And you're going to be celebrating, you're going to have a big celebration in November at the Tribeca.
Exactly.
92nd Street.
November 13th, we're going to put together, there aren't too many originals left. I think Charlie's Persephone is still playing with us in Candido. Clark Terry is still with us, but I think he's in Arkansas. All the others are ancestors, but we're going to celebrate, you know. Yes.
Uhuru! Freedom! Freedom first.
Africa, where the great Congo flows.
Africa!
Where the whole jungle knows a new dawning breaks.
Africa!
A young nation awakes.
Africa!
Uhuru!
Africa!
Uhuru! Africa, ambako jua la angaza sana. Africa, ambako ulimwengu wote kwanza. Africa, kutoka usiku wa jana. Uhuru, upepo wa uhuru. Upepo wa uhuru unavuma. The freedom wind blows. Out of yesterday's night, uhuru. Uhuru. Uhuru.
Thank you.
You also talk in the book about the struggle to actually get the album released after you already have the concept for it. And this also comes, it seems to me, it comes a little bit really before the curve, before people start getting a little bit more into Africa and developing that sort of consciousness. How difficult was it for you to actually do that?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, in life, there's certain people that come at certain times in your life, you know, and they make a contribution. And it was a man called C.B. Atkins. C.B. Atkins was a husband of Sarah Vaughan. And somehow I met C.B. and I told him what I wanted to do. And he talked to the head of Roulette Records. And that's how we did it. But they didn't know what we were going to do until we did it, you know. So it was quite controversial because, you know, the whole idea was to, for us to forget Africa. And the image of Africa was put in such a negative way in Hollywood and the newspapers and the journals. But it was something meant to be. And it was mm-hmm. incredible because everybody was on time. And we had African people from all over the planet all come together. We only had about two or three rehearsals, but we had the same foundation. Because, you see, music itself was created in Africa, and music came out of Africa. And everything we do is based upon that foundation of African spirituality. And it was there during that recording.
You mentioned your relationship with Langston Hughes. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? How did you meet and wind up doing things together?
I was very fortunate. It was a very bad period after the Second World War. I was in the Army 3 years. You know, I came back, and a lot of the guys came back, and that's when they decided to spread the heroin and alcohol amongst our people. And it was always given to the artists, because the artists are the ones who influence people, you know. It was terrible, and I lost a lot of close friends. It was a disaster for the black community. So, but the Creator arranged for me through a wonderful semi-pro basketball player named Lefty Morris. He said, Randy, you get out of New York, you go up to the Berkshires. Now, at that time, I was running my father's restaurant in Brooklyn. And we had a restaurant that was open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We had the hippest jukebox in the world. Had the latest of Monk or Sarah Vaughan or Ella or Basie or Duke. At the same time, we had modern music of Europe. We had Stravinsky, Shostakovich, Prokofiev. Musicians would come all the time to the restaurant, whether it was Charlie Parker or Max Roach or Monk, always talking about music. So anyhow, I left New York and I went to the Berkshires. I went up there doing all kinds of work just to get out of New York. And that area is where the Boston Symphony Orchestra performs 7 weeks of the year. And students come from all over, in Lenox, Mass. They come all over the world to study opera, all European music, but the best people. At the same time, it was a place called Music Inn. And I went there with two young ladies who I was working with at a particular resort called the Seven Hills. And they said to me, Randy, here there's a place where there's some jazz. Maybe you'd like to come. And I went to this place called the Music Inn. I arrived at the right moment. And here was Professor Marshall Stern, English teacher from Hunter University, but he was also one of our first, shall we say, jazz scholars. And when I went to this resort, he had about 200 people, and he was playing some music, and he played Fletcher Henderson King's Porter Stomp, and he played Benny Goodman's King Porter Stomp. And he asked the audience, could they hear the difference? Thank you. And then I got to know Marshall, and I realized he was the only critic I knew that started off the history of jazz with West Africa. And so he brought to this place called the Music Inn. That's where I met Langston Hughes. That's where I met Babatunde Olatunji. That's where I met Jeffrey Hola from Trinidad. That's where I met Candida from Cuba. That's where I met Mahalia Jackson. That's where I met Butterfly McQueen. He had this global concept of African culture. I met Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry. So that's where I met Langston. And then I got to be very close to Langston. We just had a natural rapport. And his two secretaries had an apartment on 13th Street in Manhattan. And they wanted to get back to Harlem. They gave me the apartment. And with Marshall Stearns, I started doing the history of jazz in the schools. This is like 1958, early 60s. And we would start off with Africa as the beginning of the music. And then we would end with Africa. And I put together a group, and we do music from Africa. We do the Caribbean. We do the Black Church. And the last piece was always the African cookbook, which I wrote, which meant that Africa is the past, the present, and the future. And Langston, we did a couple of things together like that. And he wrote the first book for children on jazz, Langston. He was brilliant. Not only a great poet and a great writer, but he also was very close to the music. And I didn't realize how close we was until we went to Nigeria together in 1961. And there were 29 of us went for a group called the American Society of African Culture. With that group was Nina Simone, Lyle Hampton, Langston Hughes, Jeffrey Holder, Brock Peters, Alan Mims and Leon James, two dancers from the Savoy Ballroom, Martha Flowers, a great singer, Hale Woodruff, It was an incredible group, and that's when I got to realize how popular Langston Hughes was in Nigeria. And we spent 10 wonderful days together. And what happened, unfortunately, when he passed, only Langston could do this. It was in his will that he wanted me to play his funeral with the trio. And also in the will to make sure the musicians got union scale. So that was my spiritual mentor amongst others, Langston Hughes. Yeah.
In talking about Uhuru Africa, African Lady, was recorded by Abby Lincoln. She did record it on Straight Ahead.
Yes, she just sure did.
Yeah. Do you want to tell me about your relationship with Abby Lincoln? Or?
Well, I met Abby because of Max Roach. For us, Max Roach, he was the emperor of Brooklyn. Mm. He was the guy. Mm-hmm. Because at his apartment, I met Charlie Parker. At his apartment, I met Dizzy Gillespie. At his apartment, I met Leo Parker, Miles Davis, George Russell, at Max's place. So when him and Abby came together, that's when I met Abby Lincoln. And she was like Max. She's a great artist, but very conscious of our people, very dedicated to our people. and very dedicated to the ancestors, you know. And when she did that recording, she did African Lady. I was very happy about, and she also did it with Max, you know. So that was a wonderful relationship. Growing up with giants like that, you know, very inspiring, yes.
Well, in the book, I believe in the chapter on Uhuru Africa, you actually choose an epigraph from Dr. John Henrik Clark, and you also included him in the conference program for the 1961 Afro-American Musician Society. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your relationship, because we don't often hear about Dr. Clark in relation to the music.
Well, you know, it was a lot of discrimination against African-American musicians, you see. So we decided to form an organization. We called it the Afro-American Musician Society. This was in 1961. And we would have meetings up at the Marketplace Gallery on 135th Street in Harlem. We'd have meetings at my apartment. When I say we, I'm talking about Melba Liston. I'm talking about John Handy, Sadiq Hakim, Nadi Kamar, Louis Brown, myself, and Ray Bryant, the great pianist. And we decided to have a convention of African-American musicians. And we got to St. Philip's Church. We approached Reverend Weston, and he gave us three days. And we had a three-day conference. And that conference, we invited musicians from Maine all the way to Florida to try to form an organization. So we had two keynote speakers. One was A. Philip Randolph, who talked to us about labor rights. And we had John Henry Clark to teach us about our culture and who we were as a people. So from that moment up until he passed, John Henry Clark has played a major role in my life. He was a brilliant, brilliant man.
Now, ultimately, at least the story you tell is that, unfortunately, the society did not really take off. And why is that? Or what were a few of the forces that made it difficult for you to move that organization ahead?
Well, it was, you know, Africa. African-American didn't exist at that particular time, you know. Deliberately, to cut us off from the richest place on the planet, which is our ancestral home, Africa, you see. So it was controversial. It shouldn't have been, because in the early part of the 20th century, people like U.B. Blake and James Reed Sherup and Ellington, they all identified with the continent, you see. But later on, we got separated from what our ancestors laid down. Marcus Garvey, all these people recognized that we were an African people and taken away from our homeland. So it was kind of difficult, you know, but much easier than what our ancestors went through.
That's true.
Much easier.
Well, I guess as a possible follow-up to that, can you talk a little bit about the African Union and your recent trip to the continent over the summer? Because I know they had an unveiling of a very large and impressive monument.
Oh, what an experience. It took place in Dakar on the 4th of April, and my wife and I were there, and it was hard to explain. This statue is huge. It's probably maybe the biggest statue in the world, bigger than the Statue of Liberty, bigger than Rio de Janeiro, huge. And this statue is the African family, this African man, the African woman, and the child. And it was so colorful. People came from all over Africa. We were with a group of 100 African-Americans, and the president of Senegal, President Wade, arranged a plane to take us there, you know, members of Jesse Jackson's group of PUSH and members of NACP, Ron Karenga, myself and my wife. And it was quite an experience. For me, it was spiritually powerful. And they said that this is the foundation of the day when we will have the United States of Africa. So it was quite an experience.
Well, I know one thing that Dr. Leonard Jeffries has pointed out and has said has been very symbolically powerful for him is that it's actually pointing to us, to the West, as opposed to the East.
Exactly. They said that we are the sixth African nation, those of us in South America and the Caribbean and United States. And all we have to do is claim what's ours. It's very simple. We have to claim anything that belongs to anybody else, our music, our way of life, our dance, you know. We have to get that to our children, because today they're cut off from their heritage, and we have a great heritage. And we've created so many giants. Every day I'm learning more and more about African people. Every day of my life, I'm learning something new, you see.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for January 29th. This segment features area listings of Sugar My Bowl guests so you can see them live, and tonight's show focuses on the late pianist Randy Weston with a 2010 interview we conducted with him. And we have more listings for you this week. We start with saxophonist David Murray, who hosts a record listening party at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on January 29th. Drummer Billy Hart leads a quartet at the Village Vanguard from the 29th through February 3rd. Bassist Ron Carter has a winter residency at the Blue Note on January 30th and returns on February 4th, 9th, and 10th. Drummer Leon Parker is at Mesro on the 31st. Vocalist Renee Marie is at Dizzy's Club with Ulysses Owens Jr.'s Songs of Freedom from the 31st through February 3rd. The Hypnotic Brass Ensemble is at the Blue Note from the 31st through February 3rd. Guitarist Mary Halverson is at the Jazz Gallery with Ches Smith's Quartet on the 31st. Vision Fest promoters Arts for Art take their free jazz series on the road to Holo in Ridgewood, Queens on the 31st and February 7th and 14th. Percussionist Bobby Neal Clark is at the City College of New York's Aaron Davis Hall for the Malcolm X Suite on February 1st. Saxophonist Oliver Lake is at Newark's Bethany Baptist Church for Jazz Vespers on February 2nd. Tubist Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 2nd. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Session Series continues with late Saturday night sets at Smoke on the 2nd and 9th. Looking a little further ahead, organist John Medeski is at The Stone with drummer Billy Martin on the 5th. Pianist Harold Mayburn is at Smoke for a drum battle between Kenny Washington and Joe Farnsworth on the 8th and 9th of February. Finally, flutist Bobby Humphrey is at Ginny's Supper Club on the 9th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news, and sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website, and if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on our website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our new weekly schedule. We'll be back on air next Tuesday night at 10 p.m. and have updated event listings online. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Most of your career has been as a band leader. Actually, I was wondering, how has that been? How were you able to do during that time? How were you able to have a career as a band leader?
You know, I didn't decide to be a professional musician until I was 29 years old. And I was playing when I was 17, but I didn't have the confidence to be a musician. You know why? Because I grew up in the period of royalty of piano. So when you grow up with people like Nat King Cole and Count Basie and Art Tatum and Earl Hines and Errol Garner, You got to lay back, you know. Monk and Bud Powell, you see, I used to go ahead, Willie the Lion Smith and UB Blake. I mean, awesome. All these giants, you see. So not until I was 29, after a lot of encouragement from people who heard me play, I decided I was going to be a professor, a musician. But it took some courage. And when I became a musician, first of all, I was an African child, an African man. And I saw what my mother and father went through. Piano teaching, getting 50 cents a lesson, and our people couldn't get work because of the way they looked, you know. We weren't beautiful because we had that chocolate skin and that wonderful hair, you see. So I've always been proud of my people, proud of my ancestors. So my music had to take that direction. But it was something that happened spiritually. And I had to project our music, the black church, the calypso, the blues, the jazz. Because what was so wonderful, our parents, they were the ones who took us to hear Duke Ellington, Andy Kirk, and they were the ones who bought the best music in the house. Because when we grew up, there was no such thing as separation. The music was for the young and for the old, you see. So we were lucky to have that spiritual foundation from our communities. So then my music only took that direction. But it was our heritage. I mean, you know, Louis Armstrong, all our giants, they performed for the black community. They played for benefits, for handicapped children, hospitals, you see. We were part of the community. And so I had that foundation. And listening to people like Paul Robeson and learning what it is to be an artist, learning what it is to be a musician, going to 52nd Street and watching Coleman Hawkins and watching Buck Clayton and watching Cozy Cole, you know, and just really watching this rich culture. So my direction had to be to honor the ancestors and the respect and the love they gave us, because all of them never hesitated to help us, you know. If I wanted to ask Duke Ellington something, he would tell me. If I wanted to ask Dizzy something, he would tell me, you know. So it was that wonderful giving that the giants before us were like.
You have very rare sideman gigs. There was one in particular with Roy Brooks, a percussionist, drummer, and saw player from in 1989, a duet in Detroit.
Do you have that?
I'm going to have it by the time this airs.
I don't have it. Would you get that for me?
Yes.
That's hard to describe.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to introduce just a fantastic, excellent percussionist, also a very dear friend who I haven't seen in a long time. I'm very happy to introduce Mr. Roy Brooks. Roy and I have always had very similar tastes. We've always had tremendous interest in African culture in a very deep way, in a very spiritual way. And I'm so happy to be with him tonight. Thank you.
How did you decide to be a sideman on that, or to collaborate with Roy Brooks? And tell us about Roy Brooks.
Well, you see, I had an apartment on 13th Street. At his apartment 10 years. And this was part of us to survive. So we'd have rent parties. We cook food all day. We sell everything, you know, whiskey, wine, sodas and whatnot. And in my apartment, it could be Ray Bryant playing, I could be playing. And we had different loves all throughout, yeah, musicians, you know. So that was part of the spirit. I got away from your question.
Roy Brooks.
Roy Brooks.
Tell us about
so
it.
So the wonderful thing about being born in New York, most all the great musicians come from Detroit, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Chicago, Mississippi, you name it, you know. So we could always welcome them. So I was always tight with the different musicians, you know. And I forget how Roy and I met, you know. He's a wonderful drummer. He played with me for a while, you know. And we played together at this museum in Detroit. And he played the saw, the musical saw, and I played the piano. But that goes back to the continent, because what I discovered by traveling in Africa, living in Africa, I understood better that with our ancestors, you can make music out of anything. You can make music out of a bottle, a tabletop, a matchbox, with your body, with your hands, you see. So the saw, African-Americans creating music out of the saw, out of the washboard, out of a knife and fork, you know.
Spoons.
Yeah, out of spoon, right, you know. So I forgot how we got together, but I'd love to hear that again, because hard to describe that date.
Now, I understood that Benny Powell played with you a lot. He recently transitioned.
Yeah, over 25 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
How was that relationship?
Well, Benny, let's see, I think, leaving the local 802. I forgot the year, 25 years ago, something like that. And I met Benny Powell on the corner. I forgot how we met. And we talked. We had a wonderful, you know, vibrations are important in life. And there's some people you just have a natural rapport, you know. And we talked for about an hour. And he was doing the Marl Griffin show. He was still doing the Hollywood scene. He said, man, listen, I'm going to leave that scene. I want to come in New York, you know. I said, okay, Benny. I said, you come to New York, call me, because I would love to have you play with me, you know. And Benny told me later that when he finally came in New York, he's playing with Basie's band. You know, he played with everybody, Benny Powell. Such a great trombonist. And he said, when I did call him for a gig, he couldn't make it. He said he never forgot that. But Benny Powell, he was a very spiritual human being. It was hard to describe Benny. Benny was always giving. And when he played that trombone, he wasn't just taking a solo. He was speaking. Mm. You know, trombone is close to the human voice, that sound. So when he played, he talked, you know.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. I am co-hosting tonight's program with our associate producer, Hank Williams, as we talked to our ancestor, Baba Randy Weston, pianist, composer, producer, and Pan-Africanist. For information and playlist, make sure you visit us at sugarinmybowl.org. Unfortunately, I'm not able to read back a lot. It's an extra tight show. Tighter than usual. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
And he always say, Randy, listen, you don't have gigs, you have adventures. You know, we played together in Pompeii, you know, and discovered the Temple of Isis in Pompeii, all places. He went with me to Morocco when we did a film, Randy Weston in Tangier. And the musicians, him and Billy Harper and Al Harewood, Eric Asante, a percussionist from Ghana. And they had to take donkeys to go up to this mountain up in Morocco, you know. But Benny was down, you know, going up with this musicians going on these donkeys up to the mountain, you know. So we've had every kind of experience together. And he was an incredible man because he, when we first got together, we toured Europe. We had a collaboration that I called the Spirit of Africa. We had Johnny Copeland's blues band. We had six Ghanawa people from Morocco, the black people from Morocco, three from Tangier, three from Marrakesh. And we had my regular band, you see, which was T.K. Blue, Benny Powell, and Neil Clark, and Alex Blake on bass, you know. And Benny, he had a problem, and he had to have dialysis, you know. So we stopped in hospitals, you know, three times a week in Europe for him to get on that machine to clean his blood, you know. And sometimes he'd get through and he'd be so tired. I said, Benny, why don't you just go and lay down and relax, you know. But as soon as the music started, Benny be on that stage playing. And he, for me, stands in my mind the spirituality of our music, you see. He was an incredible human being. And I'm so happy that we did several recordings together.
Tell me about the recording, Charlie Mingus and Friends. It was a concert. It was recorded in 1972. What was it like working with Charlie Mingus?
Well, I knew Charlie.
Okay.
Because Charlie and Max, we'd always meet all the time, you know. But what happened, he had a concert, and this concert was at Lincoln Center, and it was called Charlie Mingus and Friends. Okay. Now, this young lady, her name was Mary Jo Johnson. She worked for Columbia Records, and she was involved with the recording. And she invited me to attend the concert, and I was wintertime. So we went backstage, but the security wouldn't let us in. And she was furious. She had her card. They wouldn't let us in, you know. So finally, a guy who came down, I think his name was Aziz, he recognized her and recognized me, told her, hey, let them in, you know. She works for Columbia. So we walked in, and I was backstage, had on this fur hat and my winter coat, and Mingus is playing and whatnot. And Bill Cosby sees me. And he gets on the microphone and said, now we have Randy Weston on piano. So the next thing I know, I'm on the stage with this fur hat and this jacket playing this song, you know.
Thank you.
So that's how it happened. You know, and then afterwards, Columbia Records called me on the phone and said, we got a check for you. I say, what? Yeah, so that was one of those things that only happen in our music, you know.
Well, you know, you were talking about recording with Benny Powell earlier. One of those recordings was Spirit of Our Ancestors. And one of the other musicians on that recording was Pharoah Sanders. Now, we talked to Pharoah Sanders earlier this year, and we were talking about your working together and what have you, and he said that that he liked working with you, of course, but he's down whenever you're ready to do something. He's available. So are you going to be doing something together?
Why not? Yeah, Pharoah is fantastic, you know. He tells the stories of us,
yeah.
You know. He always has, him and John Coltrane and Max and Sonny Rollins. That, you know, I grew up with these giants, you know, and it's kind of a spiritual, not confrontation, but kind of like a challenge, you know. You know, it's wonderful. So when he recorded with Spirit of My Ancestors, because I had him, Dewey Redman, and Billy Harper. Mm-hmm. So you had them three guys on saxophone. It was powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always like to play with Pharoah. Always. Okay. Always.
Oh, whenever the two of you are ready, we'll be ready.
Okay. Wonderful.
Well, spirits of our ancestors also, it reminds me a little bit in terms of conception of Uhuru Africa, because you also have Dizzy on that, and I know you wanted to bring the Genoa musicians, but that didn't work out for various reasons. So what was it like doing that project and putting that together?
Oh, it was very special because, you see, they had Randy Weston Week in Brooklyn, 1985. I think it was 85, you know. And I had this wonderful big band. We played for handicapped children. Melba listened, did the arrangements. She conducted the orchestra. But soon after that, Melba had a stroke. And she could no longer play trombone. And she wasn't functioning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept, a spirit of our ancestors, came in my mind. You know, I want to do this. And when I started thinking about the songs I wanted to put together, I thought about the musicians I wanted to put together. And then I realized that Melba Liston had to do the arrangements. It could only be her. So I went to her, and I called her all kind of names. I insulted her, and I said, listen, you stroke or no stroke, you're going to do these arrangements, you know, nobody else but you. And this brilliant woman, she talked to her aunt, who was a computer specialist,
mm-hmm.
and learned how to write music with her left hand in the computer. Mm-hmm. So on that date, to see her and Dizzy Gillespie on that date, because the city of Chicago gave me a commission to write a piece for Dizzy Gillespie and Machito. And Dizzy was extremely important because not only because of the orchestra that's called Melba Liston, but Dizzy brought Chano Poza from Cuba. He brought the African drum back by way of Cuba. So to see just the two of them together, it was wonderful. So on that date, I had my son Azzedine on drums. I had Big Black on drums. Idris Muhammad. I had him on drums, and Pharaoh, thanks to him, I wanted to bring Severin Ganawa from Morocco for the recording, but that was during the time of the first war in Iraq, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody speaking Arabic had a problem at that particular time, and I couldn't get their visas. But lucky Pharaoh Sanders, he knew one Ganawa in San Francisco named Chadley, Yasir Chadley. So we got him to come to the studio. And that's how we recorded Spirit of Our Ancestors. The great Idris Suleiman on trumpet, T.K. Blue on saxophone, and we had Jamil Nasser and Alex Blake. We had two basses. I hope I leave out anybody. But again, Melba's arrangements were fabulous. Yeah.
Down.
This is actually jumping back a little bit, but you have a much longer relationship with Genoa and actually spend several years with them while you were in Africa. Can you talk a little bit about what you got from that and the type of working relationship you had?
Well, I discovered the Genoa people in Tangier in Morocco, and they are the black Moroccans. You see, we tend to only focus on slavery, those of us who were brought across the Atlantic Ocean. But slavery took place in Africa itself. And when the former great African empires were broken up, Songhai, Ghana, and Mali, African people were taken north. They were taken to Morocco, and they had to walk Sahara Desert. And like us, and wherever you find African people, you usually find a very powerful spiritual music. And I discovered them in Tangier, and I heard their music, and I met a man named Abdullah El Gourd. He was introduced to me by a Moroccan teacher at the American school who spoke English, and he told me, you got to hear Genoa people. And this guy played an instrument they called the gimbri, and it's like the mother of the banjo, you know, and it's got an incredible sound. And when this guy played this instrument, it was like hearing the way Jimmy Blanton played the bass with Duke Ellington. Because, you know, when we think of African music, we tend to think of only the drum. But Africa creates string instruments, wind instruments, you know. And when I heard this instrument, I fell in love with this instrument. And I've been with them now close to 40 years, with these people. They taught me about the spirituality of African music. And they have the power of creating music in colors. They are totally in tune with the universe. They go back to ancient times. They play games with music. They call spiritual music. They are healers with music. They do everything with music, you know. And I went to a particular ceremony, and I heard a very powerful spiritual music, a ceremony of their music. And it was like hearing jazz and blues in the black church all at the same time, you see. So it made me realize that we are just an extension of African civilization, those of us in the Western Hemisphere. And the Ghana music taught me many things, and they taught me that we have a responsibility to stay in tune with our community, because what they do, you know. And they're wonderful musicians, very powerful spiritual people. And I've taken them from to Chicago, to take them to California, Texas, Germany, Brussels. I take them all over the world. And when they play together, they have an instrument they call the kakaba. It's like a rhythm that they play, and it's incredible, very, very spiritual, very powerful. So I learned a lot from Genoa people, and they taught me about music from the African perspective, which is much older than Western civilization.
Well, you also describe actually having to get permission from them to perform Blue Moses.
Yeah, because what happened with Abdullah, by this time, I settled in Tangier. I had my children going to school in Tangier. And number one, I have to say, I love traditional music, you know. That's the key. I love traditional music in Africa. So what happened, I learned one of the traditional songs, The Color Blue, which is Blue Moses, you know. And when I learned it on the piano, and the chief of the Genoa in Tangier, his name was Fatah, and he told me that this is spiritual music. I cannot play this music in public. So I would not play it in public. After 1 year, I went to him and I said to him, I would like very much to have this music played in public because I think people need to hear this music. I will respect it. I will not sterilize it. I will give it from my heart. And then he gave me the permission. But if he didn't give me the permission, I would never play that song.
Thank you.
here in 1972, I believe, date with CTI Records. You actually do that on the electric piano. Seemed very interesting because it's, you know, it's unusual, if I can say that, in your career. How did that come about?
Well, I was living in Africa at that particular time, and the lady I mentioned before, Mary Jo Johnson, she was into the record business, and she was trying to get me a recording, and she approached 15 recording companies. Nobody was interested, you see, because I had been living in Africa at that time, you know. So I was like cut off from the so-called mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, she went to Creed Taylor of CTI. And I had written music about Morocco. And so, therefore, he was interested in me recording. And I did it originally on acoustic piano. But at that particular time, he had what they called a CTI sound.
Right.
Yeah. So to do the recording, I had to play electric piano, which people say they like. I never liked electric piano, but that's why I did it.
Have you done it since?
Once or twice on a recording I did after that with Melba called Tanja, you know, and I played a couple of times, but I don't really care for electric piano.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were telling us something earlier about your experience with an electric piano.
Yeah, on the State Department tour, you know, we did 18 countries in Africa, and some of the countries don't have pianos, you know. So they gave me an electric piano to play on, but I forgot you're supposed to approach it differently. It's not a piano. It's an electric instrument, you know.
Mm.
So sometimes I get carried away and hit it too hard, and the keys be flying up in the air.
But in the book, you also suggest that the free jazz movement has strayed from its African roots. And I think you actually say something to the effect that the music has become a little bit too electronic. I can't remember the exact words right now. But I'm wondering if there are any musicians working in that area whose work you find interesting or, you know, sound has resonated with you.
Oh, there are many. I can name a few musicians. You see, the thing is that what makes our music unique is our sound. And when you hear an African speak, we have a certain sound in our voice, you know. That goes into the instrument. So you could tell the sound of Count Basie or Duke Ellington mm-hmm. or Nat King Cole. To the same piano, the same instrument. So for me, sound is extremely important in our music. And also, when we speak about free jazz, Louis Armstrong was the freest jazz I ever heard, but mm. Louis Armstrong. You see, because you don't have to play a lot of notes to be free. You can play one note and be free, you see. So those titles are just categories that never made sense to me.
Well, I guess as a follow-up, what do you think about musicians collectives like AACM and...
And AACM is, for those who may not know.
The Association for Advancement of Creative Musicians and the orchestra and different types of alternative working relationships.
Wonderful. Musicians need to work more together. And we all were doing that in the 50s and 60s. Extremely important, you know. Very, very important.
So you've talked a lot about the important spiritual dimensions of music and also what you got growing up in Brooklyn in terms of a nurturing atmosphere and really just guidance. And I'm wondering, where does that come from right now and what outlets are there for youth to get that, to actually, continue the music and, B, just get the type of direction that they need from elders and have that type of connection that you did?
Well, I think at this point, African people, especially African leadership, we have to realize the importance of our culture. When you lose your culture, you lose your soul, you know. And, you know, we grew up with people like Jackie Robinson, Joe Louis, and Sugar Ray. They were all into the music. And this music they call jazz is African-American classical music. It's the classical music of the United States, you see. And so it's important to get to the children. They have to know the history of the blues. You know, I've had the history of all of our music and what our ancestors have given. Our ancestors have given so much, you see, and not getting the credit for that. So we have to seriously concentrate on our culture, our music, our painting, our sculpture. We don't do that enough, you see. And that has to come back because that's us. That's us, you know. And the children have to know about Louis Armstrong, about Louis Jordan, about Count Basie, about Billie Holiday, because that's how we survive. We survive racism. We survive slavery because of the music, because we couldn't speak to each other with language, but we could speak to each other through music. So we have to bring that back and let our children realize how much Africa has contributed to world civilization, how much Africa has contributed, because when our ancestors were born here, they had no musical instruments, but they had that cultural memory of Africa, because music was created in Africa, and it was created to thank the Creator for the food that we eat, you know, for the harvest, for the water, for our children, for our families, you know. It's all based upon love and respect. So we have to bring that back, and that's why it's important to know not only the music itself, but what was Duke Ellington thinking when he created? You know, what was going on at that time, you know, to create this beautiful, beautiful music?
Where do you see that coming from, either in terms of formal institutional structures or even just slightly more informal organizational structures? How can we actually bring that about?
Well, we the artists have to give back to the black communities. We have to give to the children. We have to go back. Like in the old days when we did the blues circuit, we could only play for black people. We have to get back to that, you see. I just got a blues award in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, what they're doing down there is an organization called Just Blues. They're preparing courses for the children to study the history of the blues. And the blues is African people's contribution to America, like jazz, all that type of stuff. So I think the artists, we have to get back to the roots, because in some ways we become elite. We play in places a lot of our people can't afford to pay to hear us perform. So we have to get back to the communities. And I think it's going to happen, because now in my travels, I see African culture everywhere I go now. So there's a slowly recognition, African music, African culture, architecture, philosophy, all these things, you know, are starting to come about.
Now, you've said the artists need to give back, but is there any responsibility that the community has to artists? And do you actually think we're doing as much as we need to actually support artists doing the type of work you're talking about?
Not at all. You know, it's not happening. And that's why we have to go back and study James Reese's Europe. We have to go back and study Ellington, all those people in 1920s and the 30s. They were organized. And the music, even myself, when we grew up, we played in hospitals. We played for the black community. We played for handicapped children. Because as a musician, with your talent, your responsibility, give back to where you came from, you see. So we have to get back to that, get back into the certain, there are a few black churches starting to come around now. So bring the culture back to our people. It's very important. Because when you know you come from greatness, it gives you more pride, it gives you more dignity. But if you look at the media today, children don't have an opportunity to know about the greatness of their ancestors, you see. So that's what's got to happen.
Our visiting camera person, Kazembe Balogun, is here. He's been filming our exchange. And you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you can just describe if you ever played the East. And also, can you talk a little bit about the downtown jazz scene of the 70s, of the loft scene as well? What was that about in terms of, like, alternative institutions that supported jazz? Thanks.
Well, I played the East, you know. Yeah, it was great. It was the East because it was education and music, you know. So that was so wonderful about the East, right in Brooklyn, you know. And but, see, I moved to Africa in 1967, so I wasn't on the scene in the 70s.
You played Studio Rivby, the Sam Rivers Studio?
Oh, that was earlier. Oh, yeah, that was at Sam Rivers Studio. That was in the 60s. Yeah, when we were all, you know, rebelling and giving rent parties and trying to keep alive, you know. because the clubs weren't paying very much. There wasn't that much work. So we have rent parties, and that was done at Sam Rivers' place. And I had Alex Blake on bass and my son Azadine Weston on percussion. And we recorded a song I wrote for my father called A Portrait of Frank Edward Weston, who was responsible for giving me piano lessons and also gave me Africa. So that was that. Yeah.
Our closing question is, where do you see the music going in terms of creative direction and marketability and the like?
I don't know.
Good answer.
I don't know. But I think it's going to come around. I think we're going to claim what belongs to us as a people. And I think we're going to slowly start to recognize our music and what a major contribution we've made, not only to the United States, but to the whole planet, you know. My number one fan club of all places in Kyoto in Japan. When I go to Japan, I play African rhythms. I go to Europe, I play African rhythms, you know. And the people are just so moved. So it's happening here, slowly, but I think it's going to turn around, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Randy Weston, for joining us on Sugar in My Bowl. And thank you, Hank Williams, for contributing.
Thank you, Randy, Joyce, and Kazembe.
Oh.
Yes?
You're welcome.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.